What's up? This is episode 126. You know, the nature of products is changing, and the way we make products is also changing rapidly. Today, we are going to talk about that and more. This is a topical Zoom episode. Let's do it. One, two, three.
Welcome to the Design Your Thinking Podcast, a show where we think, learn, and explore the product mindset so you can design better products every day. And now your host, Karthik.
Hey there, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining me again today on the Design Your Thinking Podcast. This is a topical Zoom episode and I'm your host, Karthik. I'm so excited with the topic that we are going to be talking about today, which is adaptation and evolution. Well, we are not talking about the human race here, but then we are talking about product and user. Well, we make products and the way we made products has changed quite a bit over the last 10 years, and it's constantly changing. Today, we are in an age where we are talking about products that we can't see, we hear, that are voice interfaces. There are a lot of nuances to the way we define a product itself. So, we are here talking to someone who has been doing product management, and also he's gone back and forth between doing that and user experience research, and he's also a musician. Well, if you've been listening to the show for a long time, you know how interesting these conversations can get with people who have a background in music. So, I really don't want to stand between you and my guest any longer. But before we went ahead with the episode, I'd like to introduce you to the Tiny Book of Triggers, a project, you know, that I've been working on in the recent times. As product managers and designers, we are passionate about our work and always are looking to explore new areas to learn and grow our knowledge, skills, and career. We sometimes pick a book, listen to a podcast, or take up a course in the quest of gaining knowledge. The Tiny Book of Triggers is a tool for product managers and designers to explore new learning opportunities. It's a book that covers 12 topics and has about 120 triggers. These triggers are essentially, you know, actions that help you get started with learning something new. The Tiny Book of Triggers gets updated regularly with more triggers compiled from successful practitioners and experts who've been on this show. The goal is to constantly bombard you or give you a supply of more triggers, ideas to help you stay on top of your learning and career goals. To get yourself a copy of the Tiny Book of Triggers, just head over to tinybookoftriggers.com. That's tinybookoftriggers.com. All right, let's jump right back into our show and our topic here. Let me quickly give you an introduction to our guest before we jump right into the episode. Our guest today is keenly focused on user experience and evidence-driven product development. He's currently Senior Product Manager of Search and Relevance at Zendesk. As a former UX researcher at AppFolio, a product manager at Pendo, AdKeeper, and RichFX, a startup founder, and product team coach. He has a perspective that spans individual roles, domains, and products. His viral enthusiasm has been heard through speaking engagements at Agile 2015, Heart of Agile Philadelphia, and various product camps and meetups. Mixing in some less than typical experiences, driving rickshaws in New York City and touring the US with five other weird creative people in a van playing music, he blogs prolifically about collaboration, product development, diversity, UX research, and lean startup and user experience. Some notable posts include the evolving product manager role, persona non grata, 12 signs you're working in a feature factory, and stop setting up product roadmaps to fail. Let's welcome John Cutler. John, welcome to the show. Super stoked to have you with us today.
Yeah, great to meet you. And nice to be on the podcast.
Awesome. So, John, you seem to have done multiple things in your career. you know, you've been a game developer. I think that's how you started your career. And then you went on to do UX research, which is one of my favorite professions, by the way, and then my favorite, product management. Could you quickly talk about this journey and, you know, just help us understand what made you do these transitions from game development to UX to PM?
Oh, that's a question I ask myself often, especially when I try to write a resume or try to put something together to explain. But there was a step in there, actually, that I don't talk about a lot. I did spend a good part of my 20s playing music, touring in bands and performing my own music when anyone would come and check it out. And I got a chance to travel a lot in the United States. And you know, this was the kind of the story of my 20s. Sweet. To do this. And so, you know, I did the video game stuff. The video game thing was literally a spur of the moment trip to Sears, at the time Sears Roebuck, mm-hmm. with a credit card. And I bought a computer and I said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make a bartending video game. So the game that I made was a bartending simulation. And it had all sorts of funny characters come in and order drinks, and you had to try to get to the final level and to meet Bacchus, the god of wine. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very, you know, young person thing to do. I quit school. I left college, and mm-hmm. I got heavily involved in that. And then I did the music stuff in my 20s into early 30s. I was always doing jobs also on the side, working at maybe, you know, investment banks and a lot of other stuff that I don't include. I guess, you know, I've sort of found my voice and found my career a little later on, but I've always, one thread through all these things I've been doing is sort of this curiosity, I guess, or kind of creative impulse to create things and build things and be with other people who are very passionate about making things and writing music and building stuff. And so I think that's probably the thread that transcends all these things. I've had the real pleasure of working with some just wonderful people. I'm just not the type of person to stay at a job for, you know, 3, 5, 7 years. Mm-hmm. It's just who I am. Right. So I don't know. I'm an explorer, and who knows, maybe next year I'll start something completely different. So
that's pretty interesting. I mean, I've lost track of it, but then I think you're the 7th or 8th person who's a musician who's been on the show.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. We should start a band. We should start.
Right. And there is a full band. I have a percussionist. I have a lead guitarist. I don't know what you play, but then there is a full band here. So great.
Nice.
So, you know, you talked about curiosity. Is there something else that's kind of, I mean, in hindsight, that you see is common between all these different kinds of roles and gigs that you've played so far that is kind of making you go back?
You know, I think that there is a energy you get when you are working side by side people and exploring these, you know, often complex challenges that is just exhilarating to me. I can't think of a better way to describe it, really. And it's an addiction to wrapping your head around these sort of systemic issues in organizations as well, or in our products, or with users, or with customers. I just find it exhilarating. You know, I think that a lot of people, maybe not a lot, but some people get into product because it's just what they think they should do. Oh, I'm not a super technical person, and I'm not, you know, I don't really fit the mold of, you know, the power suit business person, so I'm going to do product management because it's a thing. And what I love about product management and UX especially is just the variety of other motivations that people get into this. You know, everyone has an itch to scratch, it seems. Mm-hmm. And I did write a post a little while ago, it's, you know, something to the why askers or the, you know, the sort of thinkers. And I do think that that is something that I love, and I love about the people that I work with. There's a certain mold that many UX folks and product folks, not all, fit in that. And you can see it in their eyes, and I love that. You know, they're the person in the meeting when someone is talking about, you know, got to ship this, or we've got to build this for the customer. You can see it in their eyes. They're saying, what's the the outcome here? You know, what's the, how am I going to do something? Anyway, that's what I love. And it's a long answer, but it's, there is that. I'm addicted to that. I love that. And in fact, I was addicted to it when I was playing music as well, because you get the same thing. You know, you get that excitement when everything comes together. And then, you know, you're also in a van with a bunch of like crazy people.
Right.
And you have to work it out. So I don't know if that helps answer your question, but there is a spark that I love about it.
Totally. And I get it. I completely get it. You know, so talking about product management and talking about UX, you know, I have a deep interest in seeing how these roles play out, and how have they played out in the past and how they play out in the future as well. So maybe in the next few questions, I'd like to dig a little deeper into your mind. You know, you wrote this article called Product Management Must Adapt some time back. And there were a few points I saw there that I thought we should talk a little more about. So you describe in a nice little table, you talk about this whole present and the future of product management. And in one of those things, you talk about how product management is about product today and how it will be about service or touch point design tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate that a little bit for us really quick?
Sure. You know, before I even dig into it too, I think that the word product is a very difficult word. You know, the word mm-hmm. service is a very difficult word. So, you know, I apologize in advance for the degree to which I've butchered these words, but here's what's in my mind. Mm-hmm. That if you look at the ecosystems within which we are trying to deliver value to humans, mm-hmm. these ecosystems are becoming increasingly dissimilar to wrapped products or wrapped software products. And a lot of times what I notice is that you find UX folks and product folks who sort of wave their hands and say, you don't understand, everything's different now. And you don't get it. And I think it's important to take a step back and say, products exist in socio-technical, you know, socio-economic and cultural environment, right? And mm-hmm. and literally the shifts that we're seeing are just are sea trends over decades, right? In just the nature of technology, how people are interacting with technology, mm-hmm. How people are building this stuff. I mean, think even 15 years ago, just, oh my goodness, there's a million people accessing a web page. Right. You know, like that was crazy. The idea that you could have a business-to-business, I mean, I work currently at Zendesk. The mm-hmm. idea you could have a business-to-business software that has 100,000 plus customers, so more touch points than I can fit on a whiteboard, right? And super complex service ecosystem. And our customers themselves exist in a complex service ecosystem. They're trying to deliver value to their customers over the phone, through chat, you know, through artificial intelligence. I mean, that's a great example there of, if you think in a pure product perspective that your SaaS product is simply layering on features one on top of each other, sort of your Michelangelo, and mm-hmm. you're building your perfect creation just one little piece at a time, and that's your mindset, what you're missing is the idea that you're delivering these capabilities mm-hmm. that next year you'll find a better way to deliver that capability. You know, what involves a user going to an interface and trying to respond to that interface 1 year, 4 years from now might be an Internet of Things device where the user is only passively involved in getting that value and mm-hmm. that capability. So long answer, but as we see the changes in these types of sort of delivery environments, and as you see things like the UK government with their service design efforts, mm-hmm. over, you know, so many touch points, think of how complex that is and interesting that is. So what I meant by the shift from a product to a service thing is, I'm not trying to diss product managers. I'm not saying the world's going to end. I'm saying that our world is changing. Right. And what I've found is that the traditions of service design, the traditions of these things are such valuable resources to tap into at this point that if we fail to tap into them, we're doing a disservice to our users and to our businesses. And that's generally what I was trying to communicate.
Right, right. Totally get it. And in the process of explaining that, you did talk about, you use the word user so many times that I'm actually tempted to ask you this question, which is, I mean, in this whole milieu of change from that you describe, do you see, you know, the roles of what we call as product managers today and designers today change? Do you see them kind of forged together, or maybe should be forged, should have been done that way today as well? I don't know.
Yeah, I would. If I had an organization, I probably wouldn't even have a title of product manager.
Right.
I know that's controversial to say that. I might have analysts. I might say that there's certain, you know, value stream advocates or, mm-hmm. you know, analysts or things. I think that I've worked in organizations where these roles were merging beyond the point of being able to distinguish them, mm-hmm. right? Where the UX researcher and interaction designer and team was so self-sufficient in terms of being able to tackle almost all things that a decade ago would have been like highly prescriptive product manager as proxy type things.
Right.
That and in reality, what I keep saying to people is what this does is it frees up those of us who wear certain hats to really focus on really interesting problems.
Right.
You know, the traditional block and tackling product manager who, even to this day, if I ask people how much time did you spend each day doing strategic thinking as a product manager, mm-hmm. it's their side project, right? How interesting is that, right? So I see that these worlds are merging, but I very much respect the traditions. Right. Sometimes people call me out on Twitter for, you know, saying you don't respect my particular tradition. I absolutely respect the traditions. I just see them becoming, you know, more intertwined and closer together. You need the right hats.
Totally.
You know, and the crazy thing is, I think I was talking to Nate. I always forget to pronounce his name. He wrote a book called Product Leadership with Martin from Mind the Product, mm-hmm. and he's the chief experience officer. He sits in the sort of middle of the org, but he listed the dream teams for his particular teams. They included a data scientist. They included a UX researcher. They included a visual designer. They included an interaction designer. They included people who understood, you know, data engineering, just that role, data engineering. They, you know, so what's fascinating is we're just having to wear more hats. Our world is becoming the nature of our products are becoming more complex, and to be competitive, you need to have more hats at the table. So I'm going to leave it to you to see if that made any sense, but perhaps you could let me know.
No, I totally get it. I mean, that's the reason I asked. I actually put words in your mouth, to be frank. So let's move on here. On a related scale, you know, one of the things that I've been pretty curious about is with the advent of bots and, you know, the AI stuff that you just mentioned, I see some changes happening in the landscape, but I'm not too sure. I don't want to put words now, but then how do you see the notion of customers and users change in the changing landscape that you kind of defined in the little thing?
So I'm going to just say straight, I'm fairly biased in my point of view. So I don't think I have a very dogmatic fixation on human beings in the sense that when someone depersonifies human beings in some type of landscape and talks, I've been in meetings where someone is trying to sell AI and I'm the person in the back of the room rolling my eyes. And the reason why I'm rolling my eyes is not because I think I see all the wonderful potential that these approaches can provide to us. Wonderful potential. But I'm always the guy beating the drum for the human being, mm-hmm. right? To be able to get these things. Now, I think what comes to mind when thinking about your question is, you know, you have this idea of more passive use. So this idea of like interfaceless products, right? Mm-hmm. Things that are more intertwined. And what's fascinating to me, the idea is this idea that the user or customer is hiring this sort of virtual assistant, right? Mm-hmm. The metaphor I love to use is, if you think of an existing SaaS product at the moment, code is scripted service design. It is scripted service design. You are telling a machine, with the involvement of the user, to respond to situations in a certain way. Now the spectrum happens to be very tilted towards the user. That was this idea of systems of record, right? Mm-hmm. Then we started to understand that the world was a little bit more complicated and that we had more opportunities, and social media came and it became systems of engagement. Mm-hmm. And now people talk about systems of insight or, you know, systems of whatever, and it's this continuum, right? So mm-hmm. I think I'm cautious because I feel like I'm dropping a lot of buzzwords to myself, but my intent is pure here, right? So what I'm trying to describe is that I think, let me try to summarize. Human beings matter. The technology allows amazing things. I always stick to the human being who's receiving value. Mm-hmm. And I think that the customer user dichotomy, especially in business to business, you know, in the world that I'm in currently, it's just so indistinguishable sometimes to tell the difference between the two. You know, the user of today will in 3 years be selecting their solution at the next company. Mm-hmm. Right? So anyway, I've thrown a lot of words at you, but I think that, yeah, in summary, human beings matter. And think to humans. Right now, 80% of all machine learning problems can be solved with, you know, one of 10 solutions. Mm-hmm. And data engineering and cleaning the data and moving the data around is 80% of the time that people are spending on these solutions. And when you think about it that way, it's very daunting for organizations because this is not a plug and play thing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you have to keep humans in mind. Like, keep the humans in mind.
Totally. Talking about humans, it brings this other point that you make in that article about people or teams interfacing directly with customers. And, at least let's keep this in this, stick this purely to the process, to the development process. So, you know, I've seen companies like Drift, for instance, talk about what they call as responsive development or RD practice. You know, have you seen interesting ways in which the teams you have worked with, or, you know, two teams you've heard other product managers and teams work with, you know, managing to bring in this whole customer interaction into everyday work? You can talk about processes and stuff here, maybe.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I had the pleasure of working in a company in Southern California where as a UX researcher, my role was more of a facilitatory role. Mm-hmm. And I was the person arranging the visit and going in the van with a group of people, of developers, to go on site with a customer. Mm-hmm. You know, I was not doing prescriptive research for them 3 months in advance, right? I was trying to take them along on the journey.
Right.
And what's fascinating to me actually about your question, I'm going to try to keep it in context too, because lately business to business software, B2B to C software is kind of on my mind. Mm-hmm. But in so many environments, the organization takes numerous decisions that effectively separates the teams from customers and users. Mm-hmm. It's inadvertent often. It's compliance issues or, you know, certain teams only own that relationship. Mm-hmm. And so the first number one thing I would say that the structural issue is, what is stopping any of your engineers or person on the teams from picking up the phone and calling a customer? What is it? And I think that often people get into some very advanced techniques, which I love. I love the advanced techniques like involving customers directly in design sprints, or, you know, all like inviting customers on site into your organization, or going to visit customers, or mm-hmm. building for a small group of 8 people who are in your customer research panel that you talk to every day. All these are very advanced and interesting techniques, but you can't make it happen unless you remove the basic barriers. The minute someone needs to ask for permission to contact a customer, mm-hmm. you've already decreased your efficacy by some percent. And so I think, you know, short answer to your question is start with the basics. Can you pick up the phone, or even better, can you pose questions to users inside your application, which I've done very effectively. I worked at a company called Pendo, which does in-app messaging effectively. And one of the best uses of that tool was to intercept the right user or customer at the right time and invite them into a conversation right there. Book a meeting with me and the team. And that was fascinating. I said to customers, you know, you book the meeting. Here's our calendar. We will show up whenever you book the meeting. And in, you know, when sometimes I see product managers struggling to get one user on the phone, we effectively in 20 minutes had meetings scheduled for the next 3 weeks. You know, 20 customers, 10 customers, 30 customers. So back to the basics. Break down, just make it easy to contact users. I know it seems too simplistic, but that's my that's my shtick.
So just curious here, I mean, since you talked about Pendo and you talked about how you transform, so to speak, a simple customer interaction into a meeting and or a detailed conversation here, how do you go about transferring that conversation, the secondary one, the meeting, into the product? Were there any insights that you'd like to share?
You know, I think that the insight, it's not really an insight, I just feel it's common sense, is I think you have to divide these types of conversations with customers into context building and then very actionable conversations. And you need a good balance of those types of conversations, because oftentimes, especially when teams are trying to get far ahead of an effort, you know, they're trying to land the 747 on the aircraft carrier 3 months from now, they have these very contextual high-level conversations and someone takes notes, or maybe you have a transcript, and they try to go deep into these things, but it's not you lose the emotional impact of those conversations, right? And so I think that I believe that teams should endeavor to be on the phone with customers about something or anything for a couple hours of every week. Make the investment. But try to split up those types of conversations very decidedly between the more context building, empathy building, higher level conversations, and then the very actionable, we're solving a problem for you right now type conversations. A great example I had of that is I remember at a company we had a hack day, and you know, an engineer had noticed that there was some sort of break in the flow of our search flow in the product. And we literally, you know, within it started early in the morning, and we kind of got an hour or two into it. We had some lunch. We pulled some data from the product, and we thought, you know, it looks like people, our customers, are wasting 2 to 3 hours a piece simply waiting for a page to load between two parts of a flow. And later that night, we started working on it. And the next morning, because of the time difference, we actually got customers on the phone. And none of the other Hackday teams did that, right? None of the other teams went out there and actually usability tested their solution. And it was funny because I was working with some older guys on the project. We had families and significant others. We went home at 9 that night. And meanwhile, all the other developers are working until, you know, to get their demo done at 5:30 in the morning. The demo's not working. And we did the most simple thing, and we called customers at 6, you know, we arrived early and called customers, and we got quotes from them. And you could tell the minute that they saw this change, it was very, what my point is, it was very actionable.
Right.
Right. And when you make it actionable, you know, good things happen. So anyway, long story short, I think that balancing of energy in the conversations with customers is important, because if there's one thing that sours developers on these conversations, is it being very detailed but not actionable. That makes people angry.
Right.
When you do that. And the other thing I've found to be effective as well is also creating videos. So often I'll do video interviews with customers that are more higher level, less detailed, and that always allows us to get a pulse with the team, because sometimes there's not a lot of questions from the developers. It's more of a contextual interview. Right. And, you know, people are precious about their time, and I think that if we were doing a detailed interview and I did it on video and they couldn't ask questions, everyone would be pissed off.
Right.
But if it's a higher level context building interview and it's done by video and we work that in and have lunches and watch the videos, it can be nice. So I don't know, a long answer to a pretty simple question, but that's where I come from with interviews.
Awesome. I was just curious as to how you managed to take that entire conversation down to engineering. So I think that's a great way to describe how you did it. So let's move on here, John. Yeah, I tend to ask this question in a different format of the show, but you know, looking at what you've done in your articles, I'm so compelled to ask this question, which is about the product mindset. All right, I hope you've been listening to this really, really carefully, and I really hope you found value in this conversation. This is the first part of this conversation. The second part of this conversation will be continued in episode 127 that will be followed in a couple of days. But this episode itself had a lot of things that you should probably think about. The first thing that I really found standing out is this distinction that John makes between product and service / touchpoint design. Now, in the world of product management, we've traditionally talked about products. Well, that's how the role is, right? Product manager. But I've always found that to be a little funny. But then he talks about this distinction that is happening in the world where we are moving from products to services or touch points. Now, even in the UX world, in the world of design, this is changing. We are talking about service design, which is not about the design of everyday things, but it's about design of everyday experiences instead. It's about how do you design experiences for your users, your customers, the people that you're making your products for. But what's happening in the world is people are less interacting with products, but more with services. They no longer look at your product as a product, but they look at them or it as a part of a larger ecosystem of services that helps them get their job done. So that's the first thing that I really want you to think about. How is your role as a product maker changing? If you are an entrepreneur, if you are a product manager, if you are a UX researcher or a designer, whoever you are, how has your role changed or how is your role defined today? And how do you see it changing? Because the products that you make are no longer going to be used by users as your product. The brand that you are creating is no longer going to be felt by your end users as a explicit brand. It's going to be a part of a larger ecosystem. Think about it. And also try to think about the way you get feedback from your users, because in the way the products are made today and people experience these products, in this case, your customers or users, it's important that you get true feedback. Like John talks about with his experience at Pendo, it's about being able to intercept your users or your customers when they are actually interfacing or interacting with your product as a touch point, and being able to hold their attention at that moment and getting them to give you feedback. I really hope you go back, listen to this conversation another time, and take time to take notes and also think about them a little closely and think about how you can make yourself more relevant to the way consumers and users are generally consuming products today. All right, that's all I have for today. If you really enjoyed listening to this episode, I really urge you to head over to designyourthinking.com/episode 126 and find the show notes right there. You can hit up John Cutler, or you know, I have his Twitter handle right there. Or you can, of course, leave a reply right there. And if you are interested in getting the next part of this episode as soon as it's out, just head over to designyourthinking.com/iTunes if you're using Apple device, or designyourthinking.com/Stitcher if you're using an Android device. Well, I'm not using either of them, but I'm still addicted to Facebook. No problems. You can head over to designyourthinking.com/messenger. Just head over there and subscribe to the podcast, and the episodes pop in right into your Facebook Messenger as and when they are out. All right, that's all I have for today. I hope to see you with the second part of this conversation in a couple of days. And until then, stay tuned, stay inspired, keep crushing, my friend. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Design Your Thinking podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at www.designyourthinking.com.